We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out, your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Right, let me not fade my audio, feed my audio back to my microphone. As to the question of whether there was a crossfade just now, or it was just me being foolish, I can't actually answer that. I thought there might have been some kind of a crossfade, which would be very interesting. But at the moment, I can't prove it. Okay, what else is there to say on this beautiful Saturday, the 20th of April, in the glorious future year of 2024? Well, I say beautiful advisedly. Here in Munich, the capital of the Free State of Bavaria in southern Germany, where I find myself now and for the next couple of weeks, it has been snow, sleet, and hail the last 3 days. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that it has been snowing, sleeting, or hailing continuously for the past 3 days, but nevertheless, snow, sleet, and hail have occurred all 3 days. Far as I can tell, all three of them have occurred all 3 days, which is really too much for me, you know, in late April. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, the things are supposed to be trending towards the warm at this time of year. I tell you very much that if I had a Eurail pass, I would have taken the overnight train to Venice just to get away from the cold. Now, let's see. What is there to talk about? Well, first things first, the SDF admins have indeed redirected atomicblah.st to blast.manandatom.info, so that's good news for me. Currently, it only works under HTTP and not HTTPS, whereas the manandatom.info does, in fact, have HTTPS, which is really cool. Not going to use it for anything because I don't intend on collecting anyone's user data. I intend it to be largely a site which provides rather than a site which collects or absorbs. But nevertheless, it's intriguing. Anyway, so anyone wants to go take a look at that, you're welcome to. I'm, of course, happy to receive feedback. What I'm doing there is for number one of Blast, which should be available in a print version for you very, very soon. There is a file up there. It claims to be final. It is not, in fact, final. It just says so. But that's probably unfair of me to have done that, but it's That's just how things are right at the moment. Anyway, but I'd be happy if anyone would look at the site there and see what I'm doing. So on the page for the issue number one of Blast, which is dated 2023 December, it explains why it's dated 2023 December, even though, as you're well aware by now, it's already 2024 April, and the thing isn't really quite set in stone yet. But what I've done there is started to collect my various notes, explanatory notes, and references on various topics which are discussed, because what I figure the value of having a web page to go along with a paper publication is to be able to link to resources and to expand topics which there's just not enough. You know, I mean, on paper, I can only do so much, right? If you think about it, it has to be concise. I can't go wandering off into the weeds, which I think would be a grand title for a paper edition of the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, but that's another story. I can't go wandering off into the weeds, firstly because it would make the thing bulkier and thus more expensive to print and mail, but secondly because I would lose people. And so what I've got here is basically going through, and again, it's not totally finished yet, but I haven't really unleashed the thing on the world yet either. Putting in digressions and explanatory notes so that anyone who's intrigued by some of the odd things that I have to say doesn't have to go hunting all over the internet in a period when internet search is becoming less and less reliable for an explanation of what I'm talking about. And then the other thing that I have done is to take the reference section, because of course at the back there is a section which gives references for all the quotations that I've used. One of the features of Blast, as you've noticed, is a little box on nearly every page which contains some text that I found particularly apposite that I pulled from somewhere. And so in this case, I'm going through and explaining a little more about these references, and in some cases directing you to where you can find them online and read them for yourself. At the very least, giving further information so that you can hunt them down and read them for yourself. So I'm hoping that proves to be useful. Let's see. Next thing that I want to talk about is if you were listening to, in my step farther out, no, if you were listening in my Hear Now the Words time slot yesterday, that was at 1500 UTC Friday, you will have encountered. So what I did recently was I updated the payphone thing. And so I recorded a bunch of new voice prompts for the new recordings that I have to add. But the mic quality here in this room is very echoey, so I'm afraid I may have to go back and re-record those voice prompts when I get home, when I can record with the mic I usually use in the room that I usually am in, which gives me a much less hollow, echoey, sort of talking in a tin can quality. So that's... But for anybody who... I would love to get some feedback on those extra prompts. And again, of course, if you are not sure exactly what I mean by the payphone thing, publius.ntfn.org/denois/taxophone.html. But if you go to publius.ntfn, that's November Tango Foxtrot November.org, which is my SDF website, you can go to the bottom of the page and there's a link that says New Uses for Old Payphones. And that will take you to a page that gives you details about how I turned an obsolete German payphone. Some people, of course, would say that all payphones are obsolete now. I'm not entirely sure. And there are still quite a few around Munich, particularly at train stations and that kind of thing. Given that, everybody has a cell phone these days. Yeah, but on the one hand, they often fail, like they run out of power or what have you. And on the other hand, people are very reluctant to lend them to strangers because they frequently have your whole life on them, and somebody could steal your phone, somebody could run away with it, somebody could just drop it, and even though you're just as likely to do the same thing, you'd feel real bad if somebody else did it. There are lots of reasons not to hand somebody your phone. In particular, they could quickly reprogram it to do something you don't like. So having payphones for when your mobile device doesn't function as intended seems like a good thing, because mobile devices, in my experience, very often don't function as intended. You know, I have more than once lent someone a battery bank so that they could recharge their device because they did not know where they were supposed to be, etc., etc. I remember a particular instance in Dallas, Texas, where there are two steakhouses called Dunstan's on opposite sides of town. They're run by the same people, but they're two locations on opposite sides of town, and some poor woman had gone to one of the locations where I happened to be waiting for some friends, when in fact she was going to the she was supposed to go to the other one. Anyway, sorry, I don't mean to muse on the obsolescence or not of payphones, but the important part is that I have converted some older, 1990s German payphones. They're lightweight, they're mostly plastic construction. These are not payphones that were meant to be mounted outdoors for use by the general public. These are known as Club Telephone. They were meant to be mounted indoors. There was a wall mounting kit, but they were normally intended just to stand on a tabletop. And these were intended to be kept at places of business, whether that be bars or campgrounds or restaurants or what have you, just for the convenience of customers there. And so they're not as ruggedly constructed as payphones that are meant to be exposed to the general public, where you have to expect a certain level of, unfortunately, you have to expect a certain level of vandalism. And the advantage of these lightweight plastic-constructed payphones is that I can carry them with me. They're not too large or too heavy to go even in baggage that's going to be handled on an airline, which means I can take one or two with me when I'm going, say, to a science fiction convention. And there I can set up a display, and I can have this audio kiosk. And what kind of audio information kiosk is it, right? Well, I mean, the answer is I have these, and you've heard quite a number of them, I think, played during my Hear Now the Words time slots over the last year or so. I have a number of recordings, mostly vinyl records that were produced to be played over the air by broadcast radio stations and a few other things, but of informational material about nuclear energy. Because, you know, again, there's this problem. that's sometimes spoken of, the so-called information deficit model of communications, that the fact is that simply giving people information about nuclear energy isn't going to change their minds, right? That you have to get people interested first. You have to get people to want the information, and only then can the information possibly persuade them. However, firstly, there are environments where people are more likely to be interested enough to want to have the information. And then, secondly, if you can present the information in a way that makes it interesting and unexpected, and that is sort of what the payphone thing is for, is that people see it and go, what in the world is this? And they might be more receptive to the information simply because it's presented in an unexpected way. Or they say, hey, wow. Where did that come from? You know, who's doing that? Why? And so that's my—that's another part of my objective with this payphone kiosk, is to attract attention because people don't expect to see a phone and say, okay, well, what is this and what's it all about? And maybe they'll pick up the phone and maybe they'll listen to the message and say, okay, fine, I'm going to put, you know, here's a dish of little coins that operate the payphone. Okay, I'm going to put a couple in the slot and find out what this is all about. Now, I will say, additionally, that I have, you know, I am very interested in the possibility of trying to rehabilitate an outdoor-type payphone taking actual money. That would be really interesting. But I would need a place to do it, and currently I do not have that. So that's a little bit about what I've been trying to do and how I've been doing it. And if that's all sort of just very boring detail, then I apologize for wasting the past 15 minutes of your time. But I thought I might try to keep you up to date with what I've been doing and what my ideas behind it are. Just, you know, on the off chance that it proves useful to you, I guess. All right. And then what else is there to say? I mean, I could rant for a while about how stupid it is to pay for X1 is a bit dubious about an outdoor payphone, and I should explain that it would have to be in the right context. I mean, obviously, if I had a storefront, for example, if I had a storefront that said Man and Atom Society, right, if I had a little space in a strip mall or someplace, I would put the payphone on that wall, and so people coming by, you know, Man and Atom Society, what in the world is that? And then there'd be a sign that says, you know, for more information, pick up this phone and listen. But no, it would have to be in the right place. There's no point just putting it on a random street corner. Firstly, because there's no reason why anyone would stop and try to use it. If they did stop and try to use it, they might expect it to be a regular payphone, and they get real mad when they discovered it wasn't. That's not the kind of unexpected experience I want to give people. And also there's the possibility that it might be vandalized. For some reason, people like to come along and rip the handset off of payphones. I haven't yet figured out why, but they do. So yeah, if I were to do an outdoor payphone, or even a payphone in a public place, it would definitely have to be the right place. Whether that would be the foyer of a science museum, I envision this. The way I envision this is like an ATM, right? There are, if you go to the bank, it often happens that the ATM is in the foyer of the bank, so that even when the bank is closed, you can get money, right? And so if there were a like I say, if I had a storefront, which, you know, had a reading room, let's say, and again, we're talking about hundreds of dollars a month in rent, which I am currently not bringing in through the Man and Adam Patreon campaign. If you want to change that, I am very eager to do this, but I definitely need somebody to start sending me a lot more money, like 10 times as much money as I'm currently getting, and maybe that'll happen and maybe that won't. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, if I were to have such a storefront, such a location, then I would like to have something where even when my reading room wasn't open, people could come and get information. And so there's actually a space I've had my eye on, which is in a little shopping center. It's not the ideal location because it's not terribly exposed, right? It's sort of an out-of-the-way shopping center, but it's got a large plate glass window, but it's not glass front the way that most of the shops are. It's got a plate glass window and a frame, and what occurred to me was that it would be possible to put obscuring film on the inside of the glass and then mount a projector on inside the building in such a way that it threw onto that obscuring film. And most projectors have a setting where you can flip the image backwards, right? And so this could, essentially during the hours of darkness, could be used to project images that people going by could see. And so, again, people could come in the front door, and even when the, you know, either there'd be the phone immediately outside the front door, or the front door would be unlocked all the time. People could come in, and then there'd be a second door to actually get into the reading room, because I don't want people coming into the reading room where there's anything that can be damaged when I'm not there, right? But there would be some kind of information rack, right, with leaflets, booklets, the free-to-take kind of stuff, and the phone that people could pick up and listen and talk, you know, listen to informational recordings. Again, this is not a very well-worked-out idea. This is not a thoroughly worked-out idea, but I would love to have some... love to have some feedback about it, love to have some suggestions as to where, right, what kind of situation, even if I don't have my own space for this purpose, where a payphone-based info kiosk about atomic energy might be acceptable, valuable, something that people would see and use. Anyway, so this is just a thought that I have had, and I want to throw it out there, and I want to see what comes back. Anyhow, what else do I want to talk about? I do have to say that there's always some kind of election campaign going on, and the thing I always think is, boy, the stupidest thing in the world is to vote for a party when what they say is important to them, and their policy proposals are exactly 180 degrees opposite. And this is why, you know, I keep thinking about the Green Party in Germany, whose platform says, you know, our very first priority, the thing that's most important to us in the entire world, is decarbonization. But their actual policy is, oh, let's burn more coal. Right. Does that make sense? And so, yes, if anyone were to interview me for the news here, which is very unlikely to occur, I would say there isn't anything stupider than voting for somebody whose policies are diametrically opposed to what they say their priorities are. There was a European Court of Human Rights verdict very recently that, you know, basically said that protection against climate change is a human right. I'm not really sure how far that goes. Anyway, but you can now sue your government any place that the European Court of Human Rights writ runs if you think your government isn't doing enough about climate change. Well, again, I have to point out that the primary challenge now, I mean, is adaptation, because, to be blunt, it's happening. Now, completely aside from the observation that between solar cycles and geology and so forth, the climate will change no matter what we do, and if we have set things up to treat the current conditions as optimum, any change from those conditions will be a change for the worse, right? You know, what is the main thing we have to fear from sea level rise? So the answer is the wiping out of the most valuable commercial real estate in the world in places like London, New York, Tokyo, and Amsterdam that a lot of the financial market is secured against. Right? That's the key here is that, yes, you know, if global temperatures shift considerably and global weather patterns shift considerably, there will be crop failures, right? But what that means essentially is that different plants and animals will try to move into different areas. Now, what that winds up meaning in practice, you know, the thing is, obviously, annual plants can move much more rapidly than perennials, right? Forests can't move very rapidly. Forests have a relatively low speed of travel. I remember encountering a paper on exactly this topic of how fast a forest can move. And they do move, right? That if climatic conditions are more favorable on one boundary of a forest than the other, the forest will, all things equal, expand on that boundary and contract on the other boundary. So forests will move, but they can only move fairly slowly because forests, you know, forest trees don't grow very fast. They take some years to come to maturity and so on. And they can only sort of move one rank at a time. So the danger in that sense is not climate change per se, unless it's extreme. It's fast climate change. But for things like corn fields or cotton fields, you know, people saying, oh, well, you know, the places where we are growing grain won't be suitable for growing that grain anymore. Yeah, but the place immediately to the north of them will. You know, I mean, it's just a case of, in that case, you know, so they'll change what they plant in Saskatchewan, essentially. You know, and again, animals in general are more mobile, right? They can move as long as there's not a barrier in the way. So the bigger problem as far as natural ecosystems is not the climate change itself, it's the fact that humans use so much of the land. And as I have said before, if we want to use less land, if we want to make room for nature so that the natural world can be more resilient against whatever changes are occurring, then we have to intensify our use of land. In other words, we have to reduce the land we use for agriculture and for other purposes. We have to reduce the amount of water we draw from streams. And none of that is consistent with a heavy use of biofuels. None of it is consistent with a heavy use of hydropower. None of it is consistent with a heavy use of wind or solar power, really, right? So we need to use a lot more energy, but we also need to use a lot less land so that the natural world has the resilience that it needs to adapt to changing conditions, as it always has, as it always will, at least until the increasing luminosity of the sun makes it impossible for the Earth to support life at all in half a billion or a billion years from now. But also so that we have everything we need in order to survive. Because I guarantee you, plans that do not involve humans having what they need in order to survive are not good plans. And we definitely need a lot more energy, even for simple things, right? Even for simple things. I keep thinking about the problem of e-waste, electronic waste, right? And how it piles up in vast quantities all over the world, and the only really valuable things in it are gold and copper, and people are treating them in ways that release vast amounts of toxic waste to the environment, because the remainder of it is plastic and glass, which just aren't valuable enough to recycle. If you have cheap enough energy, you can mandate recycling of that, because recycling becomes much easier. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out, my scattered thoughts on the topic of humanity and technology here on Anon Radio. Write to Box 1035, Fort Worth.
Yo, check